Right, I want to ask you about your family history on this farm, right, or farming in this area.
Well, my mother was the youngest of four children, and she was left here because the others had gone away farming on their own account, which can't happen nowadays. My mum and dad got married and bought the farm in about 1952 off Croon Harbour Estate. The farm then, Manor Farm, was 125 acres. And he built up, and he used to milk about 30 cows, and he had about 50 sheep, and he always bought a new car. It was himself and a worker, plus me when I got old enough, and that's all he is now.
Can I just go back a bit? You said your mum was left in the farm,
yes,
because her brothers went off to farm elsewhere.
Can, yes,
you, can you say a little bit more about that? You couldn't do that today. What?
Well, that's right. They got farms of their own. One went to Nottingham, another went and farming in Meerbrook, and my mother's sister married a builder.
Can you say anything about your dad? What sort of background he came from?
He came from a farming background at Winkle. That's the village down there. His father was on a farm, but only a small farm. He was still farming, obviously, when my dad got married, you see, so he moved here and... So it carried on.
Tom, can you describe the land around here, like what your territory is, your 125 acres that you
That's
inherited?
Right. Yeah. Well, there's some quite good land in the valley. We had then 30 acres of meadowland, and then we'd have probably another 30, 40 acres of decent pasture land, and then the rest was rough pasture. As I say, they made a living. I mean, you didn't borrow money because you couldn't borrow money. As the things have moved on, we start, you buy one piece of land and then you buy another, and we've got, I think we own about 280 acres now. Plus we rent another 600-700 acres because we run on the Roaches estate.
So down in the valley, what sort of altitude are you... In, well, obviously it's rising quite considerably.
Yeah.
And steep,
well,
isn't
I
it?
Think the farm is 900 feet above sea level.
Right here, where we
the
are
yard.
Now. Okay.
And our manor farm runs up to 1,100 feet. And, of course, the Roach is now 1,500 feet, something like that.
So definitely you're an upland farmer.
Oh, definitely. And that is one thing that you couldn't have a scheme that covered all farms, because... You go a mile down the road and you're on all green land, very productive land. And same going uphill. If you go uphill, there's some farms up there, they've virtually no meadow land now.
So you're right on the borders of completely different territory here, aren't you? The geology of this area is very interesting, isn't it? Because
it's
just the last jagged bits of the Pennines before you head off to the Cheshire Plain.
That's right.
Yeah. Can you say what you feel about this landscape?
Oh, I think it's brilliant. I've been all over England, and I've also been abroad. And when I come over the top of the hill, coming this way, you look over the valley and the hills, and you think, fantastic. And every corner you go round this part of the world, you see a different view. Whereas some places, you'd have to go 50 miles to see anything different.
What would you say the main... efforts are that your family had to address farming in this landscape from the early days? What were the first things that you're involved in doing?
The first thing I can remember when I left school, which is 55 years ago, we used to spend all spare time draining, digging stone drains, clearing them out, and then we put so many pipe drains in to dry the land out so to make it more productive. We used to do all our stone wall building. We used to put lime on and slag. And as we built more cattle up, we improved, you know, with more farmyard manure to go on. And we did improve it a lot. It made a big difference. Well, one cow in them days would make a big difference, you see.
Has any part of this area immediately around here ever had arable crops much?
During the war, they had to grow corn. There was no problem growing it, but they could never get it ripe. Well, then never, no, not. Mostly they couldn't get the corn ripe. And since then, we have grown fodder beet, very, very successfully. But if we take a field out for fodder, but with a field less for silage. And then, of course, you've got to reseed it again, so you, by the time you finish, you're not a lot better off.
So you mentioned silage, but in the early days, you were working with hay meadows.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Never.
How many hay meadows did you have?
About six.
Is that quite a big acreage?
About 20-odd acres then, 25 acres. And then we improved the two or three pastures, which we improved those and started making silage off those.
So have you lost all the hay meadows? Have they all gone now?
We don't make any hay.
You don't make any hay?
No.
Can you say something about your memories of hay making?
Oh, yes, yes. We were talking about him the other day. We used Ted by hand. I remember when I was 12, was tending in one field, and a neighbour came out and shouted to his neighbour across the valley, because there were no phones. He says, "She's had a daughter." There was more time. Although we were busy, we'd have a think, nothing had got walking up to neighbours and having afternoon with him, you know, good natter. But it doesn't happen now. We've got something we have to do, planned virtually every day. And not necessarily grafting, but either gathering sheep or injecting them or doing something with a machine, cleaning the shed out, or, you know, we haven't got that sort of, well, what shall we do today type thing.
Your mum and your dad had about 30 cows. What did they have then?
Shorthorns,
right. Yeah. So you've carried on that tradition?
No. We went into British Frisians for 20-odd years, perhaps 30 years. And then we bought a shorthorn and we carried on. Then we'd gone to pedigree shorthorns. And I wouldn't have anything different. And then with a shorthorn, you can put any bull on it you like, a beef bull, and you have a cracking good beef animal. Because now, on the roaches, we have to run a breed at risk. That's beef shorthorn and Derbyshire Gritstones sheep. And so we have got quite a lot of beef shorthorns now. And we're going down both tracks a bit. We've still got dairy shorthorns, but we also got beef shorthorns.
What made you make the shift back to the shorthorns of your dad's farming days?
I think we happened to go to the shorthorn sale when we were... Yeah, we were down in Cheshire moving sheep and went into the shorthorns sale at Chelford and bought a shorthorn cow. And I remember saying, first time we milked it, I said, well, milk's same colour anyway. And we just went on from there, you know. And... You can't, but well, I don't think you could beat them, you know. Well, they are more suitable, because they have to walk quite a way to the fields. There's nothing really, well, it's odd field and...
They're strong cattle, aren't they?
Yes.
They've got shorter in the leg and
all
that, less vulnerable.
That's right.
And do you think, in terms of the capacity, how much milk
how's that? 6,500 litres.
Blimey, that's a lot, isn't it?
Well, it is for up here.
Yeah. So you think that they would do better than any other breed round here?
Oh,
as dairy cattle?
Definitely.
What about the temperament?
Oh, be quiet.
So you were talking about the post-war years where there was a lot of drainage and you kept on going through the 50s.
Yeah.
Through the 50s, and those were the years when you were running an increasing herd of Frisians.
You know, you kept another cow. It made a difference. And we improved the land so we could keep a few more sheep. And as I say, you didn't borrow money, but if you made a bit, it stopped with you.
Were those the years when you were increasing your holdings and buying a little bit more and a little bit
it'd be later on than that when we started buying a bit more land.
So you still got the 125 acres then?
Yes.
For how long were you working with that size parcel of land?
And I think part of it was due that odd bits of land became available, as in the old farmers died off on the small farms.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. In the 50s and 60s, you couldn't sell houses around here.
Yeah.
Because it was too far for them to travel.
Yes.
To work at even Macclesfield or, you know, they never think of it in Manchester, it was too far. So quite a few places were very cheap. And three or four houses locally went derelict for a while because nobody wanted them. So if you got a bit of land, it wasn't expensive. If you could buy a bit of land, it was reasonable money.
So that was through the 60s and 70s?
Yes.
The whole business of people thinking that they could live in quite remote rural areas and commuting. It hadn't kicked off really.
No.
Until the 80s, would you say?
That's right.
Is that when it really got going, I think? Let's go back a bit and remember, like, the days of hay meadows. So the kind of graft that was involved in cutting hay. You know, you've got your 25 acres of hay. So how did you tackle that? Who was involved?
Well, I can remember mowing with horses. And then my dad bought a tractor at 1947, probably. And he used to be all handwork. My great-grandfather planted a tree at the corner of every hay field for him to have the tea under. And that was a total waste of time because greenfly used to fall in the butties. But we used to make hay, loose hay, cart it back and put it in the shed. In them days, you didn't ring the merchant up, say, I want 10 ton of hay. You managed with what you got. That's why, early on I said about improving land, if you could improve land, you could make a bit more hay.
Is the sort of basis of this, there was a sort of closed loop in farming, wasn't there? In the old days, it's like you'd have to sustain, you'd be self-sustaining. So you, as you say, you'd have as many cattle as
you
could
keep.
You could do. So you'd be talking much smaller numbers.
Yeah.
But is that possible to go back to that?
I couldn't survive with that number of animals now.
There wouldn't be the income to maintain.
No. We've got two families, haven't we, too?
So can you describe the sort of the impact or when you first got the idea about planting silage? Did that come from government or where did it come from?
Well, it probably came from we got to a stage where we had to increase
the herd.
Yes, and we couldn't. If you go and make our hay, you can't put fertiliser on. Well, it's very difficult. It makes it very hard to get dry. So we would put fertiliser on, not necessarily nitrogen. We put a complete fertiliser on. So you grew probably a third more grass, which we could make into silage, which was a lot more guarantee than you had with hay. Because the trouble with hay, you can mow a perfectly good crop, and within 4 or 5 days, it was completely ruined by the weather. Because you've got to have 3 or 4 good days to get it dry. And that was the big thing. Your size was one of the biggest things to get be more productive.
In the 80s, we stopped increasing the dairy herd and we increased the sheep flock. When our son was leaving school, we wanted to get more income. We put the sheep into the meadows in April, so there isn't much grass growing till we can only get one cut of silage from those fields, can't we?
Let's just sort of go back now. When you were planting a lot of silage and increasing your production, so what was your herd going from in numbers from there?
Well, we went from 30-odd. We put a new shipment up. We had a shed put up and we built the walls and put all the bosgins in, and they were tied up then, Dave, for 52. So we went from 30 to 52.
So they were tied up through the winter until when? When did that system change?
Obviously, we'd be in for 6 months and out for 6 months.
Yeah.
But, and then the end thing was cubicles, you see, and parlour milking. So we had another shed up and we did all the work, me and the workmen, and put cubicles in because that was the end thing, and had a milking parlour. You have cubicles, you finish up with a lot of slurry, so we had problems with the slurry being close to the river. We had one bit of a mishap, but we've done well since. But now we've gone to loose housing, where we bed the cows down on deep bedding, and we don't get the amount of slurry.
We didn't increase the dairy herd because we're near the river,
and
we didn't want the pollution.
That danger. It's too awful, isn't it? So your herd went up to 52, but never got bigger than that. So
we're about between 50 and 60 now.
Okay, so you've kept that number for 30 years.
Yeah.
That's about the right number. Massive investment of your time,
effort, and capital in
changing all these milking systems.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
The building work. We wouldn't be able to do that nowadays. 50 cows and probably 100 sheep then, 150. And we got time to do these things. We haven't now. Chap who worked for my dad, he worked for him for 50 years. And he was always here. And he got his own small farm. And we used to build with concrete blocks. We used to rent to put 100 blocks down a day. We wouldn't have time to do that now.
Going back to the days of haymaking, but also doing this business of improving your farm and changing it, is there a bit of a cooperative approach around here, or was there in the past?
Oh, yes, there is now.
You help each other out.
Yeah, the lad who we employ, he's a farmer with his brother in his own right, and he lives at home with mum and dad, and they farm, and his uncle farms, and they come here when we are busy TB testing, and we go out then, and that's the only way you can do it.
Help each other out, don't we?
Yeah.
Do you think that's a common thing in the farming community these days?
Not when you get out to the hills.
It is around here.
I think it's the hill country,
yeah,
don't you?
That's the only...
And that's kind of so much characterises what happens here, isn't it? That you all know the challenges that you face.
Yes,
so maybe you're better at looking after each other.
Well, that's right. Yes, it'd be a very lonely place if you had to do everything you couldn't do, you know.
If we think about this decade by decade, then there's this big changes in the 70s and 80s where the herd increased, yet you've got to have a more productive farm in terms of your grass. So that was the time when you got rid of the hay meadows.
Yes.
Did you plough them and seed?
No. Just mowed the hay meadows. You couldn't afford to risk making poor hay. So you're pretty well guaranteed to make good silage, which... If you shut a field up, if you got it in hay and you got the other half of the field in silage, for some reason they probably milk better off your silage than they would off your hay. There's one thing we haven't mentioned, is that we've always done other things to make a living.
Well, let's hear about how you made the living.
Before I got married, I started sheep shearing, contract sheep shearing. So I used to go with my mates down into Cheshire and shear sheep and... make a bit extra money. And we've always done the snow ploughing around here.
All right.
Since about 1950, I think.
Not so much money in that these days.
No. No, there's none. And things like that. And then I put the water turbine in 6 years ago. That's been a good income.
Does that make you self-sufficient?
No.
No.
When we put it in, we put it onto the farm. We had a grant to do it. We found out that if you draw any other grants from the European funding, you can't get the special tariff on the electricity. So we took the wire out of the farm and put it onto the neighbouring grid and sold it all back to the board. You get 23 pence a kilowatt for every kilowatt produced, plus 4 pence the value of it going to the board. The average is about 8 kilowatts an hour. It'll do anything between 2 and 14.
Coming on to your family, you've managed, haven't you, in a way that's pretty amazing, to now get a living for your son, is it?
Andrew, yes.
Andrew. So what's Andrew's plans, Margaret?
He seems to enjoy the farming life, and he's got his wife and family. We built a house for the son across the road, didn't we? Well, the oldest son. And then he moved away with his family and did another job, and when Andrew was leaving school, so there wasn't enough work for three families. And as far as we know, he's happy to carry on farming. And his son is 9, and he's very keen to help with the farming.
But say we built a house, a second house, which you could get planning permission for, because you can if you've a second house. And now my daughter and husband have built a house on the farm, because we'd an old bungalow, as we lived in when we first married, and we know the Peak Park didn't like it, so we did a sort of a deal with them. Would they let us build a new house if we took the old bungalow down? And reluctantly they agreed. So my daughter's back on the farm. She's a school teacher assistant, and Chris was a farmer, but he's come out of farming and he fits bathrooms and kitchens. So they've got a smashing house just up the field, and you know, it's worked well.
So you've got your whole family around
there.
Your daughter and son all on the farm.
Yeah.
And how important is that to you?
It's very nice to have them around, because our daughter has two two daughters who are working now. We don't see a lot of them, but it's nice to know they're there.
Now, your son and grandson that live here, your youngest son, he works alongside you.
Yes, he runs a farm, virtually. And his wife has a few horses, because she's horse mad, you know. But she gets a bit of income off that. But it's only like a diversification. She also works 2 days a week on some computer, whatever. I had heart valve then 12 years ago. I hadn't got a problem, but doctor decided I wanted one in. And then 2.5 years ago, I had a new hip in. And I thought, it'd be great to have nothing to do, you know, sit and watch telly. I couldn't even survive in hospital more than about 5 days. I went to walk about, went watching cricket, you know, I was missing. But that's one thing I feel a bit sad with my dad. When Andrew was born, we had to move out of the old bungalow because there wasn't room. And obviously we moved down here. And he pushed him into living Mac, which my mother loved it, but he was very reluctant. And I can see why now. When you're busy, you think it'd be nice to do nothing. But try doing nothing. No use at all. So I get up in the morning, as soon as you hear the milking machine strike up, I get up and I put the silage out for the cows, feed some cattle, feed sheep. But it's all do with the machine, you know. So I am useful to them. Because you don't feel any different when you're 72 than you did at 25 up here.
Well, we couldn't afford to buy somewhere away from here because all the money that we've made has been ploughed back into the farm. So I don't know whether in the future what Andrew is, his ambition would be to carry on farming from his house he's got up across the road, or if he'll come to live here.
How old is this house?
17. 37 was it?
Is it
on the outside of that window?
And they say that's when the house was altered, I don't know.
So it might be a lot older.
Yeah. Because my brother never wanted to be a farmer. He only went to secondary modern school. He never went to college. He did a college course at home. You sit there with this pile open on his knee and I'd be tearing about, fucking cows out, looking through windows. See, what's that so-and-so doing, you know? But he went to work for British Rail as a surveyor. He's never looked back. He's got a house in York and he's a flat in London. And he's had a great life. That's what I tried to say.
Yeah.
Just because you're a farmer's son doesn't mean you're a thickhead. They know what hard work is for a start. In whatever job they go into, they're often very successful. Because they've got that work ethic.
Well, I think that's the other thing I'd just really like to say. What do you have to be a good farmer?
You've got to like what you're doing. You've got to have pride in your stock, like whatever you're doing. Like the countryside and accept the weather and this wet weather. It's like a challenge, you know. I think it's a great life. When I'm bringing cows in the morning, 6:30, the car's going down to work. They're probably working Maxfield, Congleton, Stockport, Manchester, some of them. And when we turn the cows out at night, it's 6:00, they're coming back. I know who's that best day. And I think it is a great life.